Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, March 7th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. Now, this week, I had a chance to sit down with the hilarious and energetic and just absolutely wonderful Katie McKissick. She is the creator and author of Beatrice the Biologist. But before we jump into the episode, I want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible week after week. And specifically, I want to give a shout out this week to Andrew Sanchez. Andrew, oh my goodness, thank you so, so much for your support this week. Andrew made a really generous donation. He, of course, hearkens from Stephenville, Texas, and you've been a longtime listener of the show, and I really appreciate your support over the years. I can say that, plural, years. I also want to thank those of you who have shown your support through Patreon. You visited www.patreon.com/talknerdy. Thank you so much to Phil T-Bear, Timothy Glover, The Honorable Husband, Malcolm Waddy II, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys so much from the bottom of my heart. And thank you to everybody who's been listening now for the past 100 episodes. We did a big Ask Me Anything for last week's show. You guys sent in your questions. It was a whole lot of fun, and I got some really great feedback on that. So thanks for sticking with me for the last 2 years. It really means an awful lot to me. All right, guys, without any further ado, I'm so excited about this week's episode. It's just really, really fun. So here she is, Katie McKissick. Katie, thank you so much for joining me. I've been trying to get you on the show for so long.
I know. Our
schedules haven't been lining up very well, but I'm so excited that you're
here now. The stars
have aligned. Yeah,
I'm here.
And I'm so pumped to be able to talk to you because you are so like core LA SciComm, like part of the crew. Our paths cross left and right all the time. So much fun. And I can't wait to talk about all of the really great work that you do.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This is a blast.
Yay. So I'm wondering how we should open. I think we should just dive right in because it's funny. You have this whole world, this whole SciComm kind of brand that you've developed, and you've been very successful in it, called Beatrice the Biologist, which is not your name. And so it's cool because it's this thing that exists and it's by you and your name is included, but a lot of people might already know Beatrice the Biologist but didn't know that you are the illustrator, the writer, all that good stuff.
Yeah, sometimes people feel, I think, almost betrayed when they're like, your name isn't Beatrice? What's going on this whole time? It's kind of like my alter ego. I really like having a pen name. And I think a lot of people are just like, why would you have something that's not your name? But it's so convenient because it does give you this kind of separation. And also, even some of my friends and family will address me as Beatrice if they have a science question or something. So it kind of, I don't know, it's many purpose.
That's hilarious. And so Beatrice is, of course, a biologist. Is Katie a biologist?
Yes. So I have, so my background is biology. I used to teach high school biology. So that's where a lot of the inspiration for this comes from. And I chose to call it Beatrice the Biologist, A, just because I've always really liked that name and I wanted that alliteration. And I had this idea that I've never done, but about doing a children's book about a little girl who just really liked kind of looking at leaves and looking under rocks and all that sort of stuff and just kind of going off and exploring and, you know, looking at nature. Mm. And I was going to have this part at the end where someone would kind of like basically a bully being like, well, what are you doing? You're so weird. Or I don't get it or whatever. And then the girl would just go, I'm Beatrice and I'm a biologist or something like that. It's kind of inspired by this story that my grandma told me when I think she was dropping me off at preschool. Mm-hmm. And there was this little kid. Of course, I don't remember this, so I have to just go off what she says because it sounds so weird. Apparently, some little kid in front of adults, which is why I'm like, this can't possibly have happened. But okay. But he just came over to me and went, you're a garbage head. You know, because preschoolers are awesome with the insults, of course.
That is the craziest insult I've ever heard.
Like, what? And I apparently just like turned to him and went, I'm not a garbage head. I'm Katie. Like, I don't understand. I don't know. I don't know where that girl went. Because if someone told me that now, I'd be like, yeah, you're probably right. But anyway, so there was kind of that sort of thing. Like, no, I'm not. I'm a biologist.
Yeah.
I'm a Katie or whatever I said. But so it's kind of from that. But,
I love that so much. It's like this really empowered kind of like, no, like I like bugs and that is cool.
You have to just deal with it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so you taught high school biology where?
In Los Angeles. It's the school that's, it's called Wes Adams Prep. It's actually the same school that Jamie Oliver tried to overhaul the lunches at. Do you remember that?
How like, funny.
God, how long ago was that? It was like 7 years ago.
No, I know what you're talking about. You know what's really weird is that I actually did another Jamie Oliver show with other kids here in LA that was about, he did the lunch one first, and then he did a show. It's always like he does a show in England and it's really successful, and then they try it here and it's somewhat successful. And so they did the lunch one, which makes sense, right? Because he's a chef. But then they did one called Dream School, where he where there's all these kids that were like dropouts or like at-risk kids. And so he built a dream school and he had like Oliver Stone teaching theater. And he had like, you know, all these different amazing people like Soledad O'Brien taught government or politics. And I taught one of the science classes on the dream school. And it was TV production. You know what I mean? It was fun. I wish that I had been able to spend more time there and actually teach. It's like I had two half days with the kids. But yeah, it's super weird that Jamie Oliver is like trying to like whip the schools in LA into shape.
Yeah, I know.
And so did that happen while you were there teaching?
No, no. It was, I think it was 2 years or something after, I left or something like that. There was a student that I had that I saw on the show at one point. I'm like, oh, I know her.
That's so weird.
But so there was enough overlap that, yeah, you know, there was one student that was still there.
So are you LA local? Like, were you born here?
No, I'm actually from Reno, Nevada.
Okay.
So I came down to LA to go to USC, and I've just been here ever since.
Nice. And you studied biology or teaching?
Well, I got my bachelor's in bio, and then I stayed and got my master's in teaching at USC as well. So then I was like, well, I've got a bachelor's in bio and a master's in teaching. I guess I'll teach bio. Sounds good.
So what made you, because that's, I think, an interesting turning point for a lot of people. They go to college, they study a STEM field because it interests them. And then after you get your bachelor's, depending on the STEM field, you're kind of like, what the hell do I do with this degree?
Yeah, that was me the whole time. Like ever since freshman year, I was like, what am I going to do? Because I really feel like I missed several memos. One of them was pre-med. I had never any desire to be a doctor, which was not not great news to my grandfather, who was a doctor.
So,
freshman year, I remember, you know, intro bio, the professor said, oh, so how many of you are pre-med? And I swear to God, I was one of the three people that didn't raise their hands. And it wasn't that big class. It was like 60 people or something. But I just remember all the hands shot up and I looked around and went, oh, shit. Like, what
am I doing here?
What's happening? Oh, my God. I just, again, totally missing a memo. Everybody would have known that. I was the only one that didn't. Like, of course, you know, obvious, like everybody here is pre-med, but oh, my God.
But I love that. You're like, I'm just here because it's interesting.
I really like this stuff, you guys. What are you guys doing here? And and so as a result, like almost all my friends in my science classes were pre-med. And when we got to the, you know, the O-chem and all the stuff that people were just like, oh, God, they're like, why are you doing this to yourself? Like for me, this is a means to an end. Yeah. You're just doing this because you like it. You're a freak.
Yeah. Like you're a masochist.
What's wrong with you?
Did you like O-chem?
Yeah, I liked O-chem. I mean, I didn't hate it. Yeah. I mean,
a lot of people do.
Yeah,
a lot of people hate it. I think it's cool when I meet people who like have a pure passion for things like basic chemistry or basic math. You know,
I had really good professors, though. I would say that those were some of O-chem A and B. Those were some of the strongest professors I had. So
that's very
makes
lucky.
A big difference.
Yeah, because
obviously.
For a lot of people, that is what they call like the weed out class, right? It's like the most challenging class they have to get in a biochem degree or bio degree with a chem minor, and they're like, can't do it anymore.
Yeah, I had no idea what I was going to do. And I started thinking about it freshman year. I would buy the books that were like, 50 careers for biology majors and all this kind of stuff.
That's cool that there's a book like that.
Yeah. And I was always just trying to figure out what I was going to do. And I remember, again, my grandfather, who he just kept saying, well, you know, you'll think about it. And then you'll just decide to become a doctor. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry. Your path is laid out.
Yeah, it's totally fine. I mean, he would say it with his Bronx accent, which I can't do very well. But he actually suggested I be a science writer and, you know, a science communicator.
No way.
And I, at the time, was just like, yeah, that sounds great, but how?
Yeah.
Like, to me, that sounded like someone saying, be an NBA basketball player. Easy. Yeah. Like, just do that.
Just be an astronaut.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the other thing. It was like, oh, yeah, just go to space. Like, why are you even thinking about this so hard? It's so obvious. So I really was like, that sounds great, but I don't think that's possible. I don't think I could do that. I just don't see how I would. I just couldn't see how it would line up that way.
And of course, when we were in college, the idea of a science communicator as a job, whether it existed or not, it wasn't like in the mainstream. And there were definitely not any degree programs or specialized tracks within degree programs to like help cultivate that in somebody.
I think there are some now.
I think so. It's just starting to happen.
So definitely not when I was there.
And not like these groups of people who are like, oh, we're the science communication community. Like there was no science online. There was no SciComm camp. plug right there.
It was awesome.
But yeah, it didn't exist. Like, and the idea that you would want to do that probably didn't cross anybody's mind. The fact that your grandpa planted that seed is actually quite rare and very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was really lucky because when I left teaching, I was like, well, I guess I could try to do that now.
So I guess it was kind of like in the back of your mind.
It was.
Time.
And this is just my stuff, like having kind of, I don't know, like low self-esteem in general, being like, well, I probably can't do that though.
Yeah, maybe I won't be good at it.
Yeah, because, you know, it's like, oh, it'd be really competitive. Because to me that was, oh, writing science books and you have to, you know, be going to publishers. You have to be, you know, brilliant and stuff. So,
You have like multiple books.
it did work out, but I definitely was just like, I don't think that's possible.
Yeah.
And I think if I could go back again, I probably would have majored in biomedical engineering or something more applied, because it was really weird how leaving with a biological sciences degree, I had absolutely no skills whatsoever.
It's a funny thing that unless you've done, which you probably did, but unless you've done lab work or you've done an undergraduate thesis where you go into a lab with a professor and you get some sort of like specialized training, even then, you're not really qualified to actually work in a real lab leave.
Because, I did undergraduate research. I got grant money and everything. But even then, I was like, I don't know how to do anything.
Yeah. Like, I can calibrate a pH meter. Yeah. Like, I was like, very good.
I can pipette real well.
Yeah.
But that's about it.
I had the same issue doing an undergrad, because before I went into bio, I did an undergrad in psychology. And it's just one of those things where it's like, what the fuck do you do with a research? Or mine wasn't clinical, it was much more research focused in psychology. But like, what do you do with a research degree if you don't have an advanced degree?
Yep.
Because there are jobs. We know there are jobs, but it doesn't feel like it when you first leave. It feels like, oh shit, I went in to get a bachelor's and now the only thing I'm allowed to do is get a PhD, or I have no prospects.
Yeah, or you seriously work at a lab and make, I'm not kidding, minimum wage.
Yeah, that's like $30,000 a year.
Yeah, that's why those charts I see of what your possible income will be, you know, if you have this degree versus that degree. Biology is on par with English.
Yeah.
It's the bottom of the barrel. I mean,
because it's almost like an undergrad is like the new high school diploma.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's kind of expected now. We're in a position where even though the middle class is shrinking, it is becoming more and more accessible for people to get advanced education, and more, I guess, it kind of expected.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's say you just finish high school. It's almost like being a dropout. You just finish your bachelor's. It's like having a high school diploma 40 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was definitely that case. So I looked at some of the science jobs, or I looked at working at like, I don't know, a lab in a hospital or something and just kind of running some of the blood tests. I looked at all of those kinds of like, oh, I have a bachelor's. What can I do that's in the biology world? And those pretty much are your options.
Yeah.
So I said, well, I've kind of always thought I'd be a good teacher, and I have, you know, younger siblings. So I always was, you know, it's kind of that. Kind of that same role of like, oh, teaching people who are younger, you think cool stuff and whatever. So I thought I'd be good at it. And I was. I totally loved it. My students were awesome. I love thinking about how they would think and how I could make something really engaging, or kind of how I could, you know, make a lesson plan so they would learn it kind of backwards and forwards and really retain it and enjoy it. And
so this was high school, like intro bio?
So the school where I was, West Adams Prep, I was there the first year it opened.
Mm-hmm.
So they had freshmen, sophomores, and juniors. They didn't have seniors. They did.
Okay.
Because most schools will open with one or two grades and stop, but they did three. So I had, and they also in LAUSD, sorry to give this like random background information. At the time, what they did was that ninth graders who were at grade level took something called integrated coordinated science their freshman year.
Okay.
So it would be like a quarter of, you know, physical science, a quarter of whatever. They just kind of went through a little bit of everything, and then they would take bio as a sophomore.
Gotcha.
But this school didn't want to do that. So they said, okay, the freshmen are ready. They're going to go straight to bio.
Yeah.
So I had freshmen who had, you know, obviously just come from middle school in my classes. I had sophomores that had gone to a different school their freshman year and had an ICS.
Taken integrated, yeah.
So they were with me. And then I had the juniors who had failed bio at their previous school, and they were all intermixed.
Oh, wow.
Every single class was all three just randomly.
So you had really advanced students side by side with students who were struggling, and there were like massive age, like some of them hadn't hit puberty.
Yeah, exactly. So I've got these itty bitty tiny, you know, 13, 14 year olds, depending on when their birthday is, that are just like, haven't had their growth spurts yet. So they're just like, they're babies. They're just teeny. And I have these 17 year old juniors that are just like, oh my God, you guys shut up. Like, I'm so annoyed. I just want to pass this class. Like, please stop talking. So yeah, so I have like little baby kids that can't even control their extremities practically. They're just like, ah, I'm so excited about everything. And then, you know, sophomores that are, you know, pretty chill. It's like, fine. And juniors that are just over it.
Oh my God. That's so funny.
And yeah. And so all different ages and all different ability levels and everything, just all completely mixed. So it was a challenge.
A challenge, I'm sure. And I'm thinking back to what my freshman biology class was like. Did you do lab work integrated into the lecture? It's not like in college where you split it up, right?
Right. But we didn't have many supplies. We did have microscopes, and I didn't do what a lot of people do, is particularly at schools where you don't have a lot of resources, which is you hoard them and you're like, I don't want them to break, so we're not going to use them. Some people kind of go, and people do that in their everyday lives too. Like, don't use the nice china ever. Like,
yeah,
let's
exactly.
just have it and never touch it ever.
We'll just keep it wrapped up in the really high shelf.
Exactly. So I made sure not to do that. So we did use the microscopes. I did get some prepared slides, mm-hmm. and we did, you know, the onion root tip, the cheek swab, the things that are really easy.
Things that are like free.
Yes. Yes, that's what I was looking for.
Your own body parts. That's free.
Yeah. So we had those, and luckily there was a teacher who'd been teaching for, you know, over 20 years that had some prepared specimens in jars. We had that kind of stuff.
That's nice. But you couldn't source like frogs or
I wanted
pigs?
To do dissections so bad, but there was just no way unless I mean, even if I did buy everything, I don't think that my administrators would have let me, because it requires sharp things.
Oh my God, I'm rolling my eyes. I can't see it. It's true. So, it does require sharp things, especially when they're prepared. Like,
yeah.
It's very rare, I think, in a high school class that you would dissect like a pithed frog or something that was like freshly killed. It's much more common that it would have to be a preserved
like
specimen.
The E.T. scene.
Yeah, exactly. But it's so funny to me because the preserved specimens are more dangerous. I think they're more dangerous. They're like in formalin and they smell bad. But I think they also try to stretch it out. I remember when I was in high school biology, at least, and even when I taught at biology at the university level, we did a lot of like fetal pigs. They were prepared because you would work on them for months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's literally what we did at my school too.
Yeah, you would dig around inside of them and then mm-hmm. throw them back in the bag and put them in the fridge. Yep. And it was like so
not even
gross.
At my high school, we put them in a drawer. It was like, I mean, I think it was about 2 weeks, so it wasn't months. But yeah, it was for that 2 weeks. It was vile in there.
That is so gross. You put them in a drawer.
Yeah,
so they're just like leaking.
Yeah. I mean, they were in a bag, but no, they weren't even refrigerated. It was like, okay, put it back in the bag and put it in the drawer. All right.
So gross. I love it. So your kids, at least though, they got to look at slides and you got to do some sort of integrated lab work with them, which is so important, I think, in biology. Because mm-hmm. You can't learn biology in a textbook. I mean, you can. You do. You have to. But you have to.
You can't
to...
learn by reading. No, I was kidding.
Yeah, you can't learn by reading. That's crazy. No, but you
no,
do
we
have
did
to...
do a lot of stuff. So it was good.
Spit on the microphone. It's so gross. You do have to do it. Too. But there's a lot of ways to do it. There are ways to, like, you know, talk about evolution or to talk about genetics by like going in front of the classroom and like being an allele and dancing to the left.
For sure.
Yeah. So
yeah, we acted
fun.
Out DNA replication and all that kind of stuff. So
oh, that's
it was
so
good.
Fun.
And we did go on a field trip down to the aquarium in Long Beach. So that was awesome.
Ooh.
I was like a wreck all day. I was like, please no one die. Just please. Please don't die. That's all I ask of you.
So that's a huge difference. I've only ever taught at the college level, which is way fucking easier.
Yeah.
And it's way easier because the kids pay to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they're assholes, you're like, okay, leave.
Mm-hmm.
It's so much easier. But my mom was a teacher for like, I don't fucking know, 40 years before she just retired this last year. And she teaches middle school Spanish. She taught high school Spanish for many, many years. And when I would see her just so broken down and exhausted, it was almost never because of the kids. It was always because of their fucking parents.
Yeah. I didn't have, I mean, the parents that I met were always really supportive. It
That's
was, so
good.
yeah, it, I never had parents because they would probably come and be like, why are you giving my kid a D? Like, oh
Yeah.
yeah, because I have control over what he turns in. Like, oh my God.
Exactly.
So I actually really didn't have that problem. And that's the one thing that teaching at a lower income school or an urban school, you don't tend to have as much as parents that are in your face because it's just kind of a different culture. Like they recognize that if their kid is not doing well, that it's because their kid needs more support or
Yeah.
they, and I had parents coming in asking me what to do and how to help their kid.
That's
I never
great.
had a parent come to me and say, what are you doing?
She had the struggle because she taught in a lower income school too. She had the struggle of parents not being there,
Yeah.
of parents not helping, of parents not caring, or of parents actively rejecting the idea of a path to college. And
Yeah,
saying, like,
I
that's
did
not
have
good for
that.
you.
One of
Yeah.
my truly brightest students, I mean, he was, it was just so obvious that he could go as far as he wanted. He was so bright. His parents were like, yeah, I don't think that's going to be in the cards, you
Yeah.
know, going to college. And they're like, yeah, we just can't afford it. And I'm like, dude,
There's
go to a
options.
UC and like you're in state, like take out some loans, like it's fine. And I don't want, I don't say just like, oh, just take out, you know, $200,000 in loans. I mean,
Yeah.
of course, you know, do it, you know, mellowly, whatever. But yeah, I was like, no, this is possible. I
Yeah.
swear to you.
And also, like, apply for scholarships
Yeah,
now.
dude.
Like, start filling out all those applications
Yeah, so
so
I
that you
did
can
have that.
hoard
I
your
did have
money.
people that were just like, oh, yeah, I don't think so. Like,
That's
dude,
tough.
what?
Yeah, that's
Yeah.
really tough. And so you're doing this. You're doing this for a few years. You're having a lot of fun. You're also probably very exhausted because you're waking up at like what, 5 every day, and like, ugh.
It was exhausting just because I'm really introverted. So interfacing with 200 people every day really did take everything
Oh
from me.
yeah,
I
it's
had
performance.
nothing left.
Yeah, it's like it's waking up and being in front of a camera or being on stage every day. Yeah, that probably
And
is
yeah,
just
and
so
I could I had
exhausting.
the thing that people told me all the time was to stop caring as much because they're like, well, that will help you. Sorry, I'm like
That's
laughing. Your
so
face, you're like, I'm
crazy.
sorry, Charlie, what
I
now?
know, that's so
But really,
crazy.
I mean, and that's because that's the survival kind of mode that other teachers
Yeah.
have. It's like you ha if you care about everything, then you'll you know, explode or implode, whatever.
I guess doctors have to have that same
Yeah,
thing
they were
too. It's
like, put
like,
that separation. You can't, when you go home, you have to just like not think about this at all. And you have to just like kind of just realize your limitations. Just all of that kind of put
yeah.
together was summed up with just care less.
But it's also like that's a twofold difficult thing to tell somebody because A, it feels wrong.
Yeah.
So you have to like really convince yourself that it's not wrong because
Yeah.
it's about your own survival as much as it is about the kids being amazing. Because if you burn out, can't help any of them.
Yeah.
But two, it's advice that's actually almost impossible to take. It's like when I deal with this in a very specific way when I am working and people say, okay, my biggest note right now is just be a little more natural. And you're like, what the fuck does that even mean? And it reminds me of when you're at the doctor. I always use this example. You're at the doctor and he's listening to your chest and then he's like, breathe really, really deep. And you're like, okay. And then, yeah. And then you do that a few times. And then she's like, okay, now just breathe normal. And you're like, I don't know
I don't remember
how.
how to. It's like when someone makes you aware of your own tongue, you're like,
Yeah,
God damn it.
it's so
How do I
in
even
my
forget
mouth.
about this?
It's really hard. It's
Yeah.
really hard. So, yeah, those are the kinds of things where I guess you try to take the advice as best you can, but how do you?
Yeah, I couldn't do it. I'm just not written that way. Like, I can't just not care. I don't
Yeah.
know.
I
It
also think
was.
it probably just comes with like time and cynicism.
No, totally. I mean, yeah, I would just, I don't know. But so. Yeah, I really loved it. I mean, the only time I ever got mad at my students was when like I caught a really smart one cheating off of
Oh,
someone with
yeah.
special needs. Like,
What
no joke.
the
Like, it was so, oh my God, I got that was the maddest I ever got. Like, what it was I had been gone the day before, like at professional development or something, and I had left them this stuff to do. And when I was going through and grading the papers, I noticed that his paper, the one that was pretty bright, was the exact same verbatim as one of my students who, you know, worked really hard and was on it, but she had what they call an individualized education plan, and they
Yeah.
call an IEP. She has special needs.
So she probably has some learning disorders.
Yes. So they were exactly the same. And I thought it was really weird. And I noticed that his was lower in the pile. And I
Yeah.
was like, okay. So I went over and asked her. I said, "Oh, did you work with him on this?" And she was like, "No, I did it by myself." And it was really good. She worked really hard, very
Oh,
clearly, and
yeah.
it was perfect. And I was like, "Okay." And I went over to him and I said, "Hey, did you work with her?" And he went, "No." What? Like just like kind of just played dumb. And I just looked at him and I went, "Wait a minute. So You went to the actual, you know, the basket where you hand in completed work. You went to the basket and you took hers out.
Yeah.
You copied down every word that she said and you buried yours so it would look like you turned it in first, didn't you? I just like completely, I was just, I knew. God. And he was like, yeah.
Why? And it's like, you're going to be pissed, not because like he was struggling, but because he's fucking lazy. Yeah. That's just laziness.
Yeah. I mean, it was so messed up on so many levels. I just felt my blood pressure just like go through the roof. I took him aside so that no one else could hear. And I was like, do you have any idea how fucked up this is? And he was like, no. I was like, she worked so hard. I just, whatever. Yeah. I just ran to him and I'm like, dude. I mean, like with love, but I was like, you can never do this again.
Yeah.
Come on. Who are you? Just like this kind of stuff. Like it was just, and that was how much I cared about them. I felt like it was, you know, not like they're actually like my child, but you know, I'm proud of them when they do good things. I'm ashamed of them when they do bad things. I was like, come on, you're so smart. You could have done this in 10 minutes and, you know, without even trying, but you didn't even do that. You cheated off someone who had to work really hard.
And it's like one of those things where when you're young, you don't realize it until you get older that cheating fucks you. Mm-hmm. It doesn't fuck anybody else. It's like, no, it's fine.
Well, that's right.
It's like on. Do you want to take your call?
No.
You can take it.
No.
Really?
I put it on Do Not Disturb. Why is it buzzing?
I don't know. I want to now know like what's going on.
It's my mama.
Oh, how sweet. Hi, Mom. My mom's coming to visit in a couple of days.
Oh, awesome.
I'm equal parts excited and stressed. Because she's going to come and stay in the new house, but she'll be the first person to stay there.
Oh, gotcha. So you have to work out all the kinks of like whatever might,
Totally. And like her shower doesn't have grout, so she has to use our shower. And we don't have any appliances in the kitchen yet. And whatever. But I'm excited. But yeah, it's. I guess it's funny because when you're teaching, there's a certain expectation you have of different kids that you develop after knowing them. And there's certain kids who, like, if you find them cheating, you're like, of course, Joe cheated again. You know, you're like, fuck. And then you have to figure out a way to, like, Joe and Mike, you always cheat. So now you get to split the grade, or you come up with some sort of stupid way to deal with it, send them to the principal. But then when there's, like, those kids who you just have such high hopes for and then they let you down, it's so depressing.
I don't know. I'm such a like emotional sponge too. Like things just like just get right in there. I'm like, what? Like it just, oh man, it just gets to be so bad.
But what a great experience having a chance to spend time teaching kids to understand, especially in the biological sciences, the sticking points. Like, what are the things that are really difficult? Is it glycolysis? Is it, you know, DNA replication? And what are those little moments where they go, yeah, I get it. Okay, I'm not listening anymore.
Yeah,
like, it's totally over my head now.
You know, it wasn't one of those things that was hard, because I was kind of curious to see how it would go in every class, was evolution.
Yeah.
So not a big deal.
I know.
I was not like I was really expecting a big fight or something, but no, I never had any pushback whatsoever.
Well,
it makes total sense
it does
when you're in a classroom.
Sense. But also, I think that you are lucky because you were teaching in LA.
Yeah, that's true.
Because I taught evolution in both Texas and New York. And I'll tell you what, when I taught in Texas, I was always like, oh, I'm going to get so much pushback from these like super like Bible belters. And there was a little bit, but for the most part, the kids were like, okay, yeah, it's biology class. I get it. Blah, blah. In New York, I was like, oh, when I go to New York, I'm never going to have to deal with this again. But I was teaching in a very Orthodox community. I was in Queens College, and I had multiple people be like, Professor, you don't actually believe this, do you? And
oh,
I was
my
like,
God.
It's not a belief system because it's true.
Yeah.
So, you know,
I hate when people use that word.
I know. But it was crazy.
Yeah.
Like, so it still exists out there. And also, I think maybe you're right. Like, middle school, high school, there's less of that developed political sensibility. And by the time they get into college, you do have some kind of like warrior type kids who are like,
for sure,
either ultra religious, ultra conservative, or like they've started to develop, political identity. So they have more, I don't know, reason to fight you.
Yeah, I definitely did have a lot of religious students though. And that's why I was like, oh,
yeah.
So what are we in for? But yeah, it was just,
yeah, I think
no,
it's just a more
deal.
Progressive area. And like, even if you're religious, like you can figure out a way. Even like, I grew up Mormon, and like even Mormons are kind of like, yeah, we get evolution. Like they've got weird things that they don't think it's like the cause of speciation, which is bullshit. It's like the whole basis of it. But there are things, like I talked to my dad about it and he's like, yeah, I mean, I get it. It's like, it, you know, like I get the science, man. He's very pro science.
Yeah.
But I think it was the ultra Orthodox kids.
For sure.
Yeah.
And I was I was raised Catholic. It was not like that was ever, oh yeah, don't listen to your science teacher.
Yeah, exactly.
Not,
but like
something that happened.
When I had kids in my biology lab who I wasn't allowed to touch because they were like Hasidic and you're not allowed to like, you're not allowed to have a female touch them before they get married.
You're dirty.
Yeah. So I'm trying to like teach them what to do on like the microscope and dissection, like make like a weird barrier between us. Yeah. And I'm like, ah, don't brush his shoulder. That was odd. But anyway, so you're teaching, you're having a good time, you're stressed, you're excited, you're loving it, and then you're like, SciComm. Like in the back of your head, it's like, make things for a broader audience.
Yeah.
So where did that, did you start Beatrice the Biologist while you were still a teacher?
I did not. I did pretty much right after.
Okay.
So that was sort of the plan. I got a different job that was still kind of in science land, but was so not stressful. So,
nice.
So I had a day job and I just started doing this on my own. And just started. At first, I was just writing articles really kind of with my students in mind of the things that were confusing for them, like bacteria versus virus, just because we kind of lump those together a lot of the time when we're talking about germs. So those were kind of hard for them to tease apart. So I would write an article about that. And there would usually be one little illustration or one little comic. And as I kept writing about different topics, I just slowly sort of the image to text ratio started changing. And so it started turning into, you know, paragraph image, sentence image, you know, and so on. And then I just started doing comics.
Full comic.
Like, hey, let's see if I can describe this whole concept in three panels. It kind of just was like a challenge for myself.
And so it started as basically a blog that that rolled into a much more visual comic. Did you always draw? Were you always like, oh, yeah, I've got like an artistic streak in me and this would be fun?
Yeah, I have always been a big doodler. Uh-huh. And I did take one art class in college just for fun. So that was a blast. And yeah, like my whole family, honestly, is pretty artistically inclined. I'm definitely not the best of them at all. And like I never took any graphic design or anything like that. So all of my stuff is always kind of rudimentary in a certain sense. But I do really like drawing. And even when I was in middle school, I wanted to be a cartoonist. That was kind of the first thing that I really wanted to be. And I remember my mom got me one of those books. It's like, how to be a cartoonist and how big do you make the word bubbles and what are the different kinds of fonts you use for different reasons, you know, whatever.
Oh, how funny. So you're like hearkening back to that as you're working, like now that you're an adult. And so like, how do you actually make all of your beautiful designs? Did it start with hand drawing and then it moved into using software?
Yeah, so everything was hand-drawn at the beginning. Actually, I take that back. The very first like two or three illustrations I did were on the computer, but they took me forever because I just wasn't as comfortable with Adobe Illustrator and things like that. So they were really basic because I was just using shapes more or less. But then I had this one job where I had a scanner on my desk.
Nice.
So I seriously was just doing pencil drawings. I wasn't even calling them in. I just was scanning pencil drawings all the time and just dropping them into the posts. And then it slowly turned into, oh, I'll just use color pencils and do these. So some of my first comics are just scanned color pencil drawings. And then I started getting a little more sophisticated and I would draw something, ink it, scan it, and then put it into Illustrator and do a live trace where the program just turns all of your artwork into vector so you can scale it and size it. And then I would just color it in that way.
Gotcha.
So it would look a lot more polished and you wouldn't have... And you wouldn't have the issue of scanning it and like losing some of the colors or getting like the actual texture of the paper in there and things like that. And that was when I could start putting it on like on a t-shirt or printing up a sticker of it because it was really good quality and all that stuff.
And did you just teach yourself Illustrator as you went? Did you ever say at a certain point you hit a sticking point or a wall and say like, I should take a class on this or I should, I don't know. I guess now you can look up YouTube videos.
Or lynda.com and stuff like that. I really was self-taught. I just kept poking around. And then I was really lucky because I do have friends that are graphic designers and stuff. So I remember there are some things I learned so far after the fact and I was using just really roundabout ways of achieving the same like thing.
Where you're like, there's a button for that.
Yeah. Like, oh my God, that's just in my preferences. God, I've been wasting so much time. Like, so I remember, I was showing someone else like the kind of the things in Illustrator that I even after years of using it, didn't pick up until someone told me. So those are the things. If someone asked me, I'm like, well, here, let me tell you what I didn't know for 5 years. And would have made it a lot easier.
And that's helpful. I mean, that's a skill you learn when you teach too, right? Because you're like, everybody does it the same way. And if you're trying to figure it out the same way, there's that one thing where you're like, oh shit, if someone had just told me that.
That one thing that you just are not going to pick it up on your own.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's probably feeds into a lot of these comics. So I'm actually going to open up the good old Googles. I'm gonna look you on up right now.
But yeah, if I could, I don't know, if I just like won the lotto and just could do whatever, I would totally go back and get a master's or something in graphic design. I would love to do that because I am just personally interested in it and love, you know, kind of coming up with like, it's almost like I'm designing a science logo sometimes when I want to come up with like a t-shirt design or something.
It's fun. So good. I'm looking at your website right now, which is also really beautiful. And I'm looking at this Dung Beetle comic, which is probably your most recent one on the site. And it's simple, but it's clean and it's really illustrative, but it looks like the bubbles, you know, the dialogue, is that your handwriting?
Let me see that one, because sometimes it is and sometimes not. No, that's my handwriting.
That's your handwriting. Yeah. I love that. I think that's so cool.
I did it a freelance project for a company, and I did a comic for them about their service. And they later on, like a year later, were like, oh, hey, we wanted to change this one word because we like changed our whatever, some of our branding. Can you tell us what font you used? Like, that's my handwriting. Sorry.
But I can write that word.
Yeah, so I just wrote it out for them again. But they were like, oh.
That's you're like, that's a proprietary font. Yeah. That's amazing. Like, that's called Beatrice. Yeah. And so you are on Patreon. I just discovered Patreon somewhat recently. So I've been putting the podcast on there. How freaking awesome is Patreon?
I know. I'm so glad it exists. Dear God.
It's so helpful because, you know, you can do things like, I have a PayPal button, which a lot of people utilize and they're really wonderful, but it's difficult and not the Patreon doesn't take a cut too, but it's like you gotta like send people there and then it's kind of a one-time thing. If you want to help out, you can help out. And you feel kind of weird asking for money, but like the whole model of Patreon, it's like you're a patron of the arts. That's really what you're doing, but it's affordable. It's like being a theater patron, except it costs $5.
Exactly. Like micro donations over time. Yeah. So we can plan and we know what to expect. Yeah, it's awesome. Oh my God.
Oh, and your Patreon page is really pretty too. See, you're so great. You actually like put stuff on here. I'm not very good at keeping up my page.
I haven't put any recent comics on there though. I should really do that. And also I make all of my Patreon posts just for my patrons. So you don't see a whole lot of the stuff that I've posted because I want it to just be for them. But I guess I could after the fact, because I post my comics early there.
Yeah, exactly. So I want it to just be for them.
I guess I could go back and make them visible for everybody, but...
Yeah, I need to come up with a way to make it, to do things that are just special for, you know, I recently did an AMA on the podcast to celebrate the 100th episode and people seem to like it. Maybe that would be a cool thing to do on Patreon, just for the patrons, is like answer questions and just post them there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never really thought about the fact that, of course, I should be putting things that are just special for them. You're giving me all sorts of good ideas. I'm so excited. Okay, so I'm looking at your website. And, of course, this Beatrice the Biologist came about as this blog, as this way to tell stories and to deliver science content in a way that people can understand and make it really visible. But, of course, it spun out into so many cool things. Like, I guess, because I'm a bad friend, I didn't realize that you have 4 books on Amazon right now.
Yeah.
Holy shit. When did that come to be? What a huge achievement.
Yeah, so 3 of them are self-published, just projects of my own. So 2 of them are comic collections that were pretty much just chronological, just some of my favorite comics from the previous year that I published it. One of them is a children's book because people so often think that I create content for children, which, I mean, I'm usually pretty good about not using curse words. Sometimes I'll say crap.
Yeah.
Like that Dung Beetle comic says crap.
Yeah. Well, because it's about crap.
Yeah. I'm sorry. There's just no way around it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm really creating comics for like high school plus.
Yeah. Because the concepts are difficult.
Yeah. They're not really for... But yeah, the aesthetic definitely would appeal to a little kid.
Oh, for sure. Because like your amoeba and your paramecium have like cute little faces. Yes. Like they're smiling at me. And your bread mold is like, hello, I'm penicillin.
And I did say there's one... And I had a teacher ask me, I did this comic where there's a proton and an electron having a conversation over non-existent cell phones, and their proton's like, electron, where the hell are you?
Yeah.
And the electron's like, that's a toughie. And then in like the next panel, he's like, I can tell you where I probably am. Yeah. Does that help? And he's all happy about it. And the proton's like, God damn, I want to kill you. So I did have a teacher who wanted to use it in her high school chemistry class, ask me to do a version where it says heck instead of hell.
Yeah.
She's like, I know my students say it. I just don't want them to hear it from me, basically. And I'm like,
and you're like, listen, you're like, oh my God, when I was teaching high school biology, I was saying fuck to my students.
Only that one time. Jeez.
No. I said fuck all the time in my bio class. I was terrible. But then again, college.
It was just so, I mean, the heck versus hell thing is kind of annoying because it's the same word.
It is. Yeah.
It's not like, I don't know, whatever.
It's like, I guess I kind of understand. It annoys me still, but I kind of understand the goddamn it thing because, like, if you are really religious, which I'm not, so it's annoying to me, but I get it. It's actually, like, offensive to you, like, right. to hear God damn it.
Yeah.
But to hear, like, gosh darn, I guess you could say gosh darn.
Yeah.
Dag nabbit.
Anyway, so I did one children's book about the different kinds of cells that are in the human body.
And you didn't put hell in it?
No, I didn't.
Good for you.
Yeah, so that's... It's like a basically like a first grade reading level in terms of sentences, but I didn't, you know, I used all the real words. It's
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So that one's fun. And then my big book, What's in Your Genes, mm-hmm. came out 2 years ago. And yeah, that's like Adams Media is one of the biggest publishers in the country. And yeah, it was so backwards. They actually emailed me and they were like, hi, do you want to write a book for us? I was like, I'm sorry. Is this spam? I totally was like, this can't be real.
Like, are you punking me
this
right now?
This email is silly. But I was like, yes, I would like that very much.
That's amazing. And so how long did it take you from being asked to the time that you actually published this thing?
So that was the other fun part about it. It was a short deadline.
Really?
It was 3 months.
Gosh, that scares me so much.
So I had to average 750 words a day.
Oh my gosh.
To make it on time. And by the way, I was also working full time as a writer. So
it's not even like you had a day job where you were doing something totally different.
No,
you were writing and
I was
you had
writing,
to come home and write.
And I had to come home and write. And that was the craziest 3 months ever, seriously, because I was writing that book. I had just gotten that science writing job where I won't say where, but whatever.
Yeah.
So I had just gotten that job. So it was still new. So I was still adjusting. And that's a source of stress, even though it was good stress.
Of course. And it's work. It's just a lot of work.
And we had just put in an offer in on a house.
And we were just talking about how fucking stressful buying a house is.
Yeah.
And then moving into that. Well, it's like every step of the way where you're like, yes, we got the house. Oh, shit. Now we have to pay for it. Yes,
yeah.
We paid for the house. Oh, shit. Now we have to move into it.
As soon as the offer is accepted, there's a million steps. It's like this inspection, that thing, or the appraisal. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Like, and in LA, things. Especially, it's like earthquake inspections.
Oh, my God.
And what's the land
And it's
like?
A whole other language. Mm-hmm. Nothing made me feel stupider than seriously like going through all the paperwork and all of the hoops to jump through to buy a house. I was like, what the hell does this sentence mean? I was calling my real estate agent constantly like, please translate. I don't know what to do. What's happening?
And the real estate agent's like, oh, I'll get back to you.
Yeah, I know.
Like, let me ask around the office.
So did that. And the grandfather I mentioned earlier died while I was writing the book very slowly. Basically, he got his cancer came back right around the time I got the book deal, and he passed away when I was about half done.
Oh, that's
so
terrible.
I wrote a good portion of it sitting by his bedside at the hospital.
And then afterward, you wrote the other half while you were grieving.
Right.
Oh, no.
Yeah. His funeral was also on my birthday.
Oh, my God. Thanks, Gramps.
Wow. Way to time it, Papa.
Yeah.
Come on.
Oh, wow. You guys were close. I mean, he was a huge inspiration for why you were even doing this in the
first
place.
Yeah, he was basically like my dad. So it was an insane 3 months. I seriously emailed pretty much everybody that would normally hear from me within 3 months. And I was like, I will not see you until July. Bye.
Yeah.
Don't call me. I'm not going to do anything. But what was funny about it was that I actually kind of enjoyed like really cocooning like that and just not talking to anybody. I had this great excuse. I didn't go to any baby showers.
No wedding.
Oh, man. I was like, nope. I actually did go to one wedding. My good friend, Dana. Dana, I went to your wedding during all of this. And I was writing in the hotel room. Like, and what I would do actually was, I'm such a crazy person with like calendars and schedules and stuff. If I wanted one day off because I wanted to take her wedding day off, I wrote an extra couple, like, an extra like 50 words like the week before, or under 100 words the week before, so that I would have that one day where I didn't have to make that writing schedule.
Wow.
I seriously had a printed up calendar with like what the word count needed to be at the end of the day.
That's great. Honestly, I mean, I'm sure it was insane, and I'm sure your husband was like, you're insane, but I
knew that because you can't fall behind, because if I missed a day without planning for it, I had to write twice as many words the next day. So it was just not possible. I just didn't let myself do it.
This is why writing a book scares the shit out of me. It's one of those things where I say all the time, I want to have written a book. I don't know yet if I want to write a book.
Writing it was easier than receiving the actual proofs and the galleys and like the final thing at the end. I had like a meltdown. I was like, oh my God, people are going to read it now. No.
And so this is coming from somebody who writes professionally. I mean, you, at this point, you're no longer a teacher. You are a full-time writer. You write professionally. And you've had odd jobs here and there where you write for different outlets. And so you've known what it means to work with an editor and all of that good mm-hmm. stuff. I've always been fascinated by this because I sometimes write. It's a part of being a science communicator. But I've never, I don't know, when I was at HuffPost, I guess I did write professionally. But I also made a lot of videos, which is easier for me. I fear that if I ever wrote professionally full-time, I would hate it. I would hate it. And I know that some people, they like writing, and then when they were they get frustrated, or they have moments where like, why do I do this? But they still in their core love it. I don't know, the minute I have to do something, I'm like so resentful that I have to do it.
Yeah.
Did you ever feel that way, or were you just full-on motivated the whole time you were doing the book? And like,
no, I never hated it. And I guess I've never come to hate writing, just because, I don't know, there's just something so satisfying about like finishing a sentence, or just finishing a paragraph, or just like reading it over and being like, yeah, that's pretty good. Like, look, I wrote that. Like, that's pretty neat. Like, so it feels fresh always for me. So I haven't gotten sick of it yet. I mean, who knows? Call me in 10 years. I might be like, I hate words.
You're like, I'm burning books in my backyard. Yes, and so you wake up in the morning and you go, I will work right after I eat breakfast. Like, that's crazy to me. I'm like, I will. Oh my gosh, that thing needs to be cleaned. And oh, I haven't.
I definitely do that too. Okay. I definitely do that too.
And then like, I'm finally starting to write.
I can't possibly concentrate while this thing is dusty.
Exactly.
Look at all that dust.
So I'm finally starting to write at like 10 p.m. And I'm like, I don't know how much I'm going to get done tonight. Yeah.
I definitely do like scheduling little breaks, because you need to be able to come back to something with fresh eyes, because there's no substitute for, you know, overnight like sleeping and coming back to it and being like, what is that?
Yeah.
Like, I never should have written it that way, or whatever. You have to be able to give yourself a break so you can come back to it, because there's only so much you can do in a certain amount of time.
Yeah, no, for sure. Have you seen this this written kitten?
Mm-mm.
I was just pulling it up because it reminded me of what you're saying. If you go to writtenkitten.co, it's basically just a little word processor, but every time you write 100 words, you get a kitten.
Oh, yes, I have heard that totally. Well, have you read Bird by Bird?
No.
Oh my God. You should read it, just because it is about the writing process
how
it can be frustrating and how to, whatever. But it's so funny. It's Anne Lamott, so it's just ridiculous. And the title is from her brother had put off doing a report on like the state's birds. I don't know, like 50 of them or something absurd. Ooh. He had put it off until the night before and had a total meltdown and was like, oh, am I going to be able to do this? And his dad, you know, Anne Lamott's dad too, just like kind of patted him on the back. He was like, bird by bird. That's how you're going to do it, buddy. Like, you waited this long. I don't know what you want from me. But yeah, but she like goes on this little mini side rant about how there's nothing more terrifying for her than when she's written maybe a couple pages in the morning and maybe goes out to run an errand and she's like, what if I die and they find those pages? They're so terrible. Like, what if that's the last thing I wrote and they find it? Like, she's a terrible writer. Like,
no, but I wasn't done.
Don't look at it.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
I highly recommend it.
I was her brother. I thrive on like scary, stressful deadlines. Mm-hmm. Like, I am the queen procrastinator. And unless I feel like the walls are going to come down on me, if I don't finish, I won't finish, which is just terrible. It's just terrible.
I have those moments too. I'm kind of like, but yeah, with the book, I was like, no, I have to like super, you know, crazy on top of it. But yeah, there's definitely things where I'm like, I'm just going to do this at the last possible second because that's what will make me do it.
So, exactly. So you do need
totally,
that. I think that's why I like production schedules, because a really good producer understands how to write it out so that you wake up at 6 and you get there at 7 and you're in hair and makeup until, you know, 8:15 and then you're lighting until whatever. And it's so specific exactly mm-hmm. what has to happen in those little, and you can do it bird by bird throughout the day, but you almost need somebody else to help you to plan it because it's so overwhelming.
Yeah.
You know, I struggle with that with the podcast. It's like, you know, we're freelance. The SciComm world is like so freelance.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of stress and pressure, but I think a lot of us thrive off of it. I love it so much more than a 9-to-5. I'm not good at 9-to-5. But there is a certain amount of responsibility that you have to take because nobody else gives a shit.
Yeah. I know. Like, I wish someone, I almost wish I did have like, I don't know, a manager or an agent that was like, so what are you doing today?
Yeah.
And how's it going? Like, I don't know. Like,
yeah.
I just like somebody to be
accountable
something.
To.
Yeah. I don't know.
And I think that's one thing that has made Patreon so helpful is that
you are responsible to somebody.
Because they're paying you to do it. And you're not going to be like, oh, I didn't feel like doing it this week.
Yeah.
Like, that's shitty.
It freaks me out that people pay me.
I know.
I spit across the room at you. Yeah, it never ceases to blow my mind. I'm like, oh my God, someone believes in me so much that they put their credit card information into Patreon and then clicked a button that says that some of it goes to me every month. What?
It's amazing. And then that allows you the freedom to do the amazing work that you do to draw the cutest dinosaur ever pooping. And also, I'm obsessed with this. I'm obsessed with amoeba hugs. They're so good because they're often fatal, you guys. And she has, so Katie brought me all of these really fun treats like stickers and like buttons.
I brought her a goodie bag.
Yeah, a goodie bag and notepads with all of like her most adorable characters. And I love her merchandise. It's so like high quality. I'm like, I was like picking her brain before we started about who she uses for merch because I really want to beef up my merch. And so you've got to visit her website because she has so much cool stuff. And I was just looking through your store. You have like all of it just available right there. Everywhere from your books, like you can find your books right there, to your t-shirts and like all this cute stuff, you know, these little, oh, you have so many mugs, cute little throw pillows and tote bags, stickers, and a Beatrice box. That's kind of like what I got.
Yeah, it's
like
basically.
All this great stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's on-demand printing. So I don't have to have stock of all this stuff.
Oh, see,
is
that's
what it is.
That's the difference. I don't have that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll show you a closet full of shit.
Exactly.
I gotta
but yeah, but
this.
I mean this stuff, like the stickers, like little things I have.
But, yeah. But it's so great.
But yeah, I mean, it's fun. Like I definitely dealt with a lot of burnout last year. Like with, you know, it's just, I don't know. Maybe it's just kind of a natural, oh, I've been doing it for 5 or 6 years, mm-hmm. depending on kind of like where I really say I started, because for a while it was really informal. But yeah, it's hard. I think maybe just as a creative person, I kind of always crave like a little bit of change or something. So I kind of want to do another book. I haven't done one in a while. And I'm starting up a podcast with my friend called Science Brunch.
Oh, I love it. Are you going to eat during the podcast? I've tried that. It's kind of gross.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I did that once. I did a podcast once with Brian Redban at Olive Garden. We thought it would be a good idea. We wore lavs so they wouldn't see us. So like the little hidden mics. And then he listened to it. I was like, Brian, when are you going to post that? And he was like, no.
It's like vomit inducing. It's like.
Yeah, it's like, first of all, super gross noises. Second of all, we lose our mics halfway through. They're like in our belly buttons. Okay. And then also he's like, Kara, we literally talked about how excited we are about breadsticks for 10 minutes. And then we just ate breadsticks. Like, it was so boring.
I fail to see the problem.
But yeah, so you're going to like have quote unquote brunch.
Yeah, we kind of go to brunch afterwards. But yeah, we just kind of talk about what's going on in science world. And we talk about historical scientists. Like one of us will do some research and kind of deliver information to the other person. And
will you do voices?
Oh, sure.
Please. Okay, that's my request that you do voices.
Okay. But yeah, so it's fun. So stuff like that to kind of keep feeling fresh and I don't know, just trying a new medium because I mean, I love doing the comics and everything, but I just really felt like I hit a wall. It was like last summer, I was just like, oh my God, what am I doing? Am I even helping anybody?
Like, it is hard. It's funny because it's like you, in the back of your mind, you're like, I want to get to a place where it's just where I have a structure and where everything is really formulaic and I'm not pushing through anymore. There's no resistance because it's just the way it is. But then once you actually get to that place and you're in it for a long time, you have a fucking existential meltdown.
Yeah.
You're like, why am I? None of it matters. It's too easy. Like you ever thought it would be too easy, but it gets to a point where it's almost like not challenging enough.
Yeah.
Or it actually induces full on writer's block.
Yeah, that too. I don't know. It was a really weird mix. And yeah, I mean, you're always in uncharted territory because mm-hmm. it's not like you're going to go backwards.
And like just redo stuff.
Yeah. So you're just always going and going, I don't know where this is heading. I'm just going to keep going this way. What?
Like, do you ever, this is what I love about science. So I feel like we made smart decisions in life because we were like, oh, we're going to communicate science.
Yeah. We're never going to run out of
anything.
Exactly.
I struggle with that when I talk to producers at production companies or like network executives and you're like, okay, I want to do a show about dinosaurs. And they'll be like, yeah, but we have to come up with at least 24 episodes at the beginning.
It's, you're like, oh no,
I know. And they're like, I don't know, are we gonna run out of material? And it's like, oh no, my god, no, guys.
Like, we're constantly discovering new things. That's like the whole point.
Yes,
so
exactly.
Don't worry about it.
And we can always talk about the things that we even have established at different level. The great mm-hmm. thing is, like, you can talk about a concept and keep talking about it for years because there's like a woman out there whose job is to focus on like dinosaur shit, and not just dinosaur shit, like one specific type of dinosaurs shit, and mm-hmm. she studies it every day, all mm-hmm. day.
Coprolites, is that what they're
yeah,
called?
Yeah, coprolites. And she's learning new things, and it's like this one very specific thing mm-hmm. is all she does. Mm-hmm. So we know that everything that we talk about, you talk about amoeba hugs, you could talk about amoebas for years.
Yeah,
there's like that much content.
Seriously.
It's so crazy.
That's what PhDs are.
Yeah.
You just look at this one dot for 5 years and then write about it.
Exactly. So we'll never run out, yeah. which is so great.
Yeah, that's true. That is something I should remind myself of more. I like really consciously say, don't worry. You're yeah. not going to run out of everything. You're yeah. going to be employed forever.
Exactly. It's like fresh Google search. So there's more stuff out there.
So much job security. Yeah. Sort of.
Sort of. But you're right. It doesn't always feel like that.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you are used to operating at a certain level, you have to shift gears. You have to dive either a little deeper or you have to broaden up.
I think what also kind of messes with me is because I follow such cool people on Twitter, Tumblr, mm-hmm. et cetera, I follow a lot of science people. So I feel like I'm in the echo chamber and I go, oh my God, I'm not even helping anyone because everybody already knows this stuff or something like that. So sometimes I get a little too in my bubble of yeah. people that already know this kind of stuff, which is why it's really helpful to have, I have really good friends that are not science people. And so they give me that reality check of, no, I do need to express this information because my really good friend who's very highly educated has no idea about it. So cool. So there's that. It's like sometimes I feel like I'm not actually filling a need because I follow so many science people.
Because you're like, somebody else already wrote about it.
Yeah, that too.
But it doesn't matter because not everybody read that yet.
Right.
And that's important.
And also I follow so many really talented people that there's that. It's just like you start to feel, or at least I start to feel like I'm just a dime a dozen. So it's yeah. like, oh.
I have the same problem. Ugh. Definitely. I look around and I'm like, am I doing anything different? And the yeah. only thing that I can tell myself is that, like, personally, I'm different. And personally, you're different. And Beatrice is different, right? Because there's nobody else who has the same perspective. Right. So even if you and I tell the same science story, we're going to tell it just that much differently because we think differently.
Right.
And that's like, it's hard though to remind ourselves of that all the time.
Totally.
Because I'll read something that like Carl Zimmer wrote, you know, or Ed Yong wrote, and I'll be like, well, there's no reason yep. for me to ever write
about
that.
Let's all go home.
But the truth of the matter is we do have different audiences too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, we reach different people care. And I have to remind myself that the people who are listening to the podcast right now aren't the people that I'm going to dinner with.
Right.
Like, my friends already know all this shit. They're mm-hmm. not my core audience. Like, my friends are probably kind of bored listening to the podcast unless I'm interviewing somebody who they're like, ooh, did you get the dirt? You know, and they're excited. But they're not the core audience. The core audience is the people who kind of get it, mm-hmm. but kind of don't.
Yeah.
And they don't spend all day, every day in the shit like we do,
yep.
you know? And you have this whole great crossover of education. That's so funny because it's like you never even anticipated that maybe younger people would be able to learn this way. But of course, all of your characters and yeah. all of your stories are adaptive to a younger audience. So you have like a whole secondary thing that you can do.
Yeah, I think the next book I'll do is probably for maybe upper elementary or yeah. something like that, because I did a lower elementary one already. But
and you can even yeah. literally start doing the same stories, but at different levels, which is
yeah.
which is nice, with the same characters.
Yeah, that too.
Oh, I love it. And you know what? I'll tell you what. You know this, but kids, especially high school and middle school kids, are just an elementary tool, are just hungry for interesting science content in the classroom, because I think most people would be surprised to hear this unless they have kids. They're still playing the Bill Nye episodes that we watched
yep.
in school.
Yeah.
Like, I was just at this makerspace for a different show and talking to all these young kids. I don't know. They were like 8 or 9. And they're like, are you famous? Do you know Bill Nye the Science Guy? And I was like, I do know Bill Nye the Science Guy. And they were like, they play his videos in the classroom, but then they referenced Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Oh my God.
Like, they're like,
I didn't think about all of the references.
All the references are out of date.
Oh man.
Isn't that crazy? Because yeah. there's nothing that's filling in that void right now.
God.
They need it. They want it. They want things that are accessible. They want things that are cute to them and that they can like have like a fun theme song and that they can identify with. And I really think that Beatrice the Biologist is so perfect because it has almost this like nerdy Sanrio quality to it. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And I know that like just young, especially young girls, but boys too, but especially young girls really identify with that, which is, you know, these are the core kids we have to get to.
Yeah. I mean, I remember going to a bookstore and looking at the science books for kids and just being horrified. Mm-hmm. It's because they're either really simplified and very babyish.
Almost to the point where it's incorrect.
Oh my God. Yeah. Just terrible. Yeah, just totally not challenging them and just totally talking down to them. I'm like, mm-hmm. did someone who actually has worked with this age group even write this? Like, yeah. who wrote this? Someone who thinks that kids are just stupid adults?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what?
Like drunk adults. Like, yeah. I'll just like explain it to your drunk
that they're
friend.
Not stupid. Like, yeah. my God. So there's those. And then I feel like the other one, and I had some of these too, are just basically like visual encyclopedias with just big pictures and teeny, teeny, tiny captions that yeah. are written at a 10th grade reading level.
Yeah, so you're what? Like, I don't get it.
There's nothing in between. It's either super, super dumbed down or just really kind of factoid laden, no actual explanation or narrative, you know, thread weaving everything together, just like blah, 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 like pictures.
Which is so dumb because when we talk, I mean, we go to science communication conferences and we collaborate with one another as people who work in the sci-com field. And one of the main mantras that we rehash over and over and over is always story, story, story. It has to be story driven. It has to be character driven.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only way to really describe science in a meaningful kind of entertaining
way. That's how our brains work.
Of
that's
course.
How, that's how we survived by telling stories about don't go over there. There was a saber-toothed cat that tried to eat me.
Yeah. And like, why would we sit here and assume, oh, that works for the grown-ups, but yeah. not the kids. Like, of course, if anybody needs story, it's children.
Seriously. And if you just work it in there, because God, I mean, kids love watching the same thing over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And they love, you know, rereading things. So they memorize everything.
That's true.
God.
And when they're too young to actually read on their own, they know the books verbatim because mm-hmm. they memorize what mom and dad
yeah,
wrote
and they
them.
Pretend they can read by yeah. just reciting it and yeah. turning the pages at the wrong times.
It's how they learn. It's yeah. so great. And I just love your characters because I think that they're both adult and really kid friendly, which is...
I mean, I'm just writing for myself, which is yeah. kind of all that anyone can do.
Because you're just a really
do.
Big kid.
Yeah. I just like... I really like that stuff. I really like SpongeBob SquarePants, etc. Like, I mean, I used to watch it when I was babysitting kids and I was like, this show is hilarious.
No, seriously.
So
there's
yeah.
so much crossover.
Yeah. I love that aesthetic. And so, yeah. So people are like, oh, it's for kids. I'm like, no, it's just for weirdos like me.
Yeah, yay. Exactly. And then the great thing is it's like any really good Disney movie or Pixar movie. The reason that the ones that are tried and true do well is they operate on two levels.
Yep.
The
yep.
kids don't get the adult jokes,
exactly.
but it still appeals to them.
Exactly.
And I think that that's what's so great about having a visual medium like you have. I think it's really, really cool. And I don't see enough of it in SciComm. There's a handful of core, you know, comic writers. There's Jorge Cham, who does PhD comics. You know, there's XKCD. There's different that are more, way more adult, obviously. They're at your level, if not older.
Yeah, it's weird that we're still having the conversation of just like visuals are really helpful, but we yeah. really actually do. I mean, I contribute to a Scientific American blog called Symbiotic, mm-hmm. like symbiotic with art in there, with Glendon Mello and Calliope Manolios. I always like stumble.
And Glendon does the paleontology stuff, right? Because doesn't
right.
he
so
draw?
He, like, yeah, like trilobites a lot. And
yes.
and Copy, easier to say, Copy Manolios is the one who drew Tiktaalik for,
gotcha.
Yeah. So they're science artists, and we actually just did this thing on Twitter called the SciArt Tweet Storm, where we just encouraged, Glendon really, you know, like took the driver's seat on it. It's his idea. It's awesome. He emailed hundreds of science artists because he just knows so many and said, hey, share a bunch of your work every day for this week and hashtag it with SciArt. And yeah, so like it's amazing because I just had this column on TweetDeck that was just nothing but SciArt. Everybody's sharing it. It's just like a really good reminder that there's so many people who take this on, and that is their craft, is explaining science visually. And, you know, remember that they're there, because sometimes people will email Glendon or myself and say, oh, hey, I really want to have a visual for this piece. Like, are there people that do this? Yes.
Yeah.
They're all over the place.
So there might not be like a core hub, you know, it might not be a thing that, like, unless you're really social media savvy, you might not know where to find it. Mm-hmm. So it's so great to have that reminder.
But not everyone's a visual thinker. So I think a lot of times if people are writing, or if there are researchers that are, you know, writing an actual research paper, the visuals can sometimes be very, very much playing second fiddle. And that doesn't necessarily need to be the way that it is.
Oh, completely. Yeah. So, it's like, let me write everything and then figure out a way to put it in a graphical kind of description, just because I probably won't get published unless I have graphs.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, does this actually tell my story better?
Yeah.
Do you understand it better because you have this graph? It's like, probably not, because it's a 3-page chart of numbers. Yeah. Like, that's not helping me.
But then, of course, I mean, there's a lot of progress. Like, people, researchers emailing Jorge Cham of PhD Comics and being like, hey, can you explain this and make an infographic about it for me? Thank you.
Totally. Like, I've talked about it now a few times at IQIM, the Institute for Quantum Information and Matter at Caltech. Crystal Dilworth, who's been on the show, helped produce this really wonderful One Enchanted Evening, a celebration of Richard Feynman. And, you know, you guys heard Chris Cantwell. He was on the show just a couple weeks ago, and he is the creator of Quantum Chess.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was this big video between Stephen Hawking and Paul Rudd that did really well.
Awesome.
And yeah, it went viral.
I love Paul Rudd so much.
Me too. And he's so funny in it. But if you had come to the evening, or if you look at the information online about it, and you can just Google One Enchanted Evening, IQIM, you'll see that Jorge Cham actually illustrated everybody's PowerPoint.
Oh, cool.
And so it didn't feel like a lecture series, and it didn't even feel like a PowerPoint. Mm-hmm. It felt like there were speakers talking about these complex quantum concepts in these really simple, graspable, comic kind of ways. And there was a continuity to it, so it felt much more, I don't know, like branded, like an event. It just didn't feel like
that's awesome
learning.
But there are still people that are just like, oh, you're not taking it seriously if you do
exactly.
that.
Or, they're resistant to it.
Yeah, there are people, and I do come across them sometimes. And it makes me sad. I feel like it's just kind of a lookist, cultural problem where they're like, oh, if you care about how you look, you can't possibly be smart, is almost what the undertone is. I don't know why we haven't moved past that yet.
I know.
But there really is that sense. It's like, oh, if you put time and energy into making it look good, then you were not putting that time and energy into more science.
Yeah, like you must be covering up the fact that there's no content there.
It's
No.
I don't know. It bums me out.
It's and it's funny because these are people who obviously have never worked within an industry outside of academia.
Where, we need to communicate to people.
Exactly.
People, you know, they need that kind of stuff around there. And it also, I mean, I think it just looks better and more professional and more appealing, whatever. But
yeah.
But of course, that's, you know, of course I would think that.
No, but it's because you're right. Like, it's true. You know, it's like, and if you talk to anybody who works in media, and granted, I have my beef with what's going on TV nowadays too, but the truth of the matter is you're never going to get anything on air if it's not entertaining first.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, let's write a show that's all heavy science content and then we'll try and make it entertaining. It's like, no, it's got to be the other way around. Let's have characters and story and interesting stuff and then like sweeten it with science. You know, that's the approach you have to take. But a lot of people don't understand that. Blend it. So anyway, we're getting in the weeds, but I love getting in the weeds. But oh my gosh, we've been going for so long. You have no idea. It's so great. I love it when I look down and I'm like, oh, that's the end of the show. But before we go, I have to close because I close every episode with the same two questions. So I have to ask you the same two questions on the spot. And actually really interested to hear what you have to say, because I don't think we've touched on anything that these two questions cover. Sometimes our episodes are super political, but this one, we're about to get there. Okay, so when you think about the future, in whatever context that matters to you, whether it's like your personal goals or whether it's kind of global harmony, all that good stuff, what is the thing, A, that keeps you up the most at night? What is the thing that makes you so concerned? What worries you about the future? And then B, on the flip side of that, what are you the most excited and hopeful for?
The things that worry me are, of course, our environment, climate change. And especially, I think it keeps me up at night because I recognize that I'm part of the problem too, because I live in the modern world and I have a car, et cetera. So that really bothers me. And I do really, really worry about it. Yeah. I remember, and I don't know. I think I'm kind of morbid. So I don't really shy away from really thinking about what the world would be like after I'm gone, yeah. et cetera. I remember telling my mom, this was several years ago, just saying that I don't even know if I ever want to have kids because mm-hmm. I don't really think we need more people. And I don't know, just talking about these big things about how like maybe we won't even be around in 100 years because we'll have completely self-destructed or something. But that actually doesn't bother me that much because life will go on.
Yeah.
And microbes that can metabolize all of the horrible stuff we've left behind us will evolve and figure it out. And things will move on from there with or without us. And it's just sort of the continuity of just like the entire universe, our planet. And that kind of comforts me. And I don't think it's comforting to very many people. Like I said that to my mom and she was like, whoa, jeez. Oh my God. Like I really scared her. But yeah, so I do worry about the near future and just, I really hope that we're changing things. Sometimes to make myself feel better, I'll watch a TED talk where someone is talking about what they're actually doing to solve these problems. And that's what gives me the most hope is that there are scientists and engineers who are on it. There are these really brilliant people who are very passionate and they're not going to just let these problems, you know, keep sliding by. There are problem solvers. They are brilliant. They are empowered. And if we can get enough people to listen to them, everything is going to be okay.
Yeah.
And so it's, I feel like at the essence, it is solvable. And I do think that we will solve it. And if we don't, the microbes will live on.
And that's so true, right? Because the real issue is it going to be us or is it going to be the cockroaches?
And yeah. And you know what? And honestly, in a much bigger sense, like a cosmic sense, it's okay if it's not us. Like we had a good shot.
Eventually it won't be us. We know that. Is it a question of a few hundred years or is it a question of a few million? But eventually it's not.
Right.
We gonna be back to being space dust.
Yeah. Nothing less. Super, super long.
But that's also, I think, kind of, I don't know, comforting and beautiful.
Yeah, I don't know. I really do find comfort in it. And again, that might just be because I'm so okay with death and things not happening forever.
Yeah, yeah. And I think a lot of that comfort comes from being devoted to the study of science.
Yeah.
I find that a lot of people who are very scientifically inclined become less afraid of death, which is almost counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people think that only religion can bring you that. And some people have both, and both of those things help. But for some people, it's pure science.
Yep.
It's understanding the life and death process that actually gives you comfort, which is quite beautiful in its own way. All right. Well, Katie, I had so much fun. And I know that we talked a little bit about it throughout the show, but go ahead and let everybody know how they can say hi, like on Twitter, Facebook, you know, different places where you exist in social media and also where they can find all of your work.
Sure. So my website is BeatriceBiologist.com. Twitter is a great place to find me. I'm at Beatrice Biology because just didn't fit. It was so annoying. But yeah, so I'm Beatrice Biology on Twitter. I'm on Tumblr, but it's not a great way to reach out to me.
Sure.
And yeah, my Facebook page is, you know, / Beatrice Biologist. Sorry.
Nice.
And again, I'm starting up this podcast with a friend called Science Brunch, and that's at sciencebrunch.org. And everything else is on my website. So, and there's a contact form. So if you want to just send me an email, I do answer them. So
Yay.
Feel free.
Oh, that's so great. Yeah. Everybody say hi, check out all of her work. It's really, really fun. And Katie, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
Jeez.
It was so much fun. I'm so glad we finally got to do it. And everybody, thank you for listening week after week. I have so much fun with you guys too. And I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.